Good to see this number here this evening. There are a number who are still sick or out for various reasons. Let's remember them, look around, see who's here or not. We do have new arrangement for the groups on Sunday night, so please note that. And it doesn't hurt if somebody wants to join the group anyway, even though they have another group. That's perfectly fine. The more the merrier. And we'll be glad to do that with one another and to participate in encouraging one another. There has been noted a little ringing in the speakers. I don't know if that's going to bother Ralph or anybody else. If it is, if it gets too annoying, just let us know. We can turn it down or turn it off or something. And if we need to adjust that, we'll try to work on that in the future and get that worked out better. See what that is about. Anyway, this evening we're going to be looking at our tongue or the speech. From time to time, we need to spend lessons on looking at different aspects of our lives and of our character. And, of course, that's what one of the main reasons we come together for. Not only is it to worship and glorify God, but to be the kind of people that will be acceptable to God as we worship Him. It does us no good whatsoever to sing these wonderful and cheerful songs about heaven and about going to heaven if we're not actually living in a way that's going to get us there. And so we want to talk about this evening, about our tongue and about speech. In Matthew 26, verses 73 and 74, there's a brief statement which we'll look at more in a little bit, but a brief statement made there to Peter. It says, "Thy speech maketh thee known." And I wanted to run off with that as our title this evening, that our speech says something about us. It betrays either good things or it demonstrates bad things about us. And so that's something that is an interesting statement. Like I said, we'll look at that as we go through at some various points. This evening, let's just start in James chapter 3. Turn over with me in the book of God, inspired word, James chapter 3, and down in verse 2, he says, "For in many things we all stumble. If any stumbleth not in word, the same is a perfect or mature man, able to bridle the whole body also. Now if we put the horses' bridles into their mouths, that they may obey us, we turn about their whole body also. Behold, the ships also, though they are so great, are driven by rough winds, are yet turned about by a very small rudder, whether the impulse of the steersman willeth. So the tongue also is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold, how much wood is kindled by how small a fire, and the tongue is a fire. The world of iniquity among our members is the tongue, which defileth the whole body and setteth on fire the wheel of nature." In other words, each generation that rolls along is that idea, wheel of nature, "and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and birds of creeping things and things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed by mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is a restless evil. It is full of deadly poison." Now this is a very dramatic passage when you think about all the pictures that are painted here describing the tongue and the potential for harm and damage and how influential that this thing can be. But that's just the point. The tongue has great influence and it has a very powerful, very large impact in our lives. It's something that is a very small member, as he says, a very little thing, like the rudder of a ship. You think about the old sailing ships, or even today, they have the rudders that they use on these ships that are just, in comparison to the ships, very small. Or you think about the horses and all the muscle and all the strength that those horses have, and you take one bit and put it in that horse's mouth, and you've got control of that horse. And so it is with the tongue, a very small member, and yet it says such a great impact upon so much that we do and that we say, and people around us that it affects so many ways. In verse 5 of James 3, we'll just want to highlight that he says, "So the tongue is also a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how much wood is kindled by how small a fire." Notice, it's one of the easiest members to use. It's a very small thing. When you stub your toe, you can say something just like that. When you meet somebody, we can greet them or we can be unkind to them. There's all sorts of things that we can do. When you have an accident and you see that impact coming, you can scream or you can say things we shouldn't say or you could pray to God very fast. There's all sorts of things that can go on with our mouth. And of course, that is stemming from our mind as we go through that. But it's a very easy member to use. But it is also the hardest member to control. Did you notice in verse 2? As he says that if any stumbleth not in word, The same as a mature man able to bridle the whole body also. In other words, if you can control the tongue, you can control anything about the body. Now that says it's on the top of the list of things that are difficult to control. That says a lot about the tongue and how hard it is to restrain that. Down in verse 7, as he talked about different kinds of beasts and birds and all the things that mankind has tamed, he says, yet in verse 8, the tongue can no man tame. It is untamable. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. You can be working on your tongue and for 10, 20, 30 years keep it under control, and one day it can slip out and just cut loose. It's never something that you can turn your back on and fully trust. You know, it's like those tigers. You know, we see those circus tigers and we see how they go for years training these tigers and teaching them to do tricks and all the things they do. And yet, not too long ago, there was a fellow that was killed by a tiger. Because they're never truly tamed. They may be trained, they may know when to jump and when to do things, but if you're not careful, those tigers will get you. There's always that element of wildness to it. And that's what he's saying about the tongue. It's a very hard member to control. It is also connected with the heart. Matthew 15, Jesus, in refuting the error of the Pharisees, how they had this doctrine that if you didn't wash your hands, then you were unclean spiritually. Jesus said that's not true. He says rather it's what comes from the heart and issues forth through the mouth. That defiles the man. And so he's talking about the mouth there, but he connects it to what's the source. The heart is where it comes from. Matthew 12 makes the same kind of statement. We see also Proverbs 4, verse 23, since we're looking at the source of the mouth and the speech is the heart. Proverbs 4, 23 says, guard the heart with all diligence, for out of it cometh forth the issues of life. All the ways, all the paths, and all the things that we do in life comes from the heart and includes the tongue. And so that's really a source, the source where we need to start. When we start talking about controlling our mouth, controlling our speech, controlling our tongue, we need to start with what's in our heart. Now, remember, the Bible heart is not just the feelings. That's a part of it. That's an aspect of it. But consistently, the Bible heart is connected with reasoning, thinking, your method and mindset of thoughts and intentions. All those things are involved in the Bible heart. And so what we're talking about there is our motives, our thoughts. What are we dwelling upon? And how are we thinking about things? And how do we view things? All of that is involved in our heart. Now let's look at a number of points concerning corrupt speech. Ephesians 4, which we'll hit as we go through this, addresses, I think it's Ephesians 4:29, addresses the fact that we are not to allow corrupt speech to issue forth out of our mouth. Don't let that proceed from us. He even goes on in chapter 5 to say, among a number of other things, that there's things that should not even be named among us, shouldn't even be heard of among Christians. And yet, sometimes we find those things. But let's look at a list of things that we know and understand are indeed connected with corrupt, or if you will, rotten, decaying speech, things which are not good and beneficial. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 21, he says, I have not written unto you because you know not the truth, but because you know it, and because no lie is of the truth. Here, look at that last statement. Because no lie is of the truth. Little ones, okay? Is that all right? Can mix and mingle that? No. No lie is of the truth. That's a blanket statement. None of them. Deception, lies, falsehood, deceit, that is not to be something that is a part of us as Christians. As those who proclaim to follow God, lying is to be something that is removed from our life. Ephesians talks about that we're put away lying and speak truth one to another, and many other passages hit on that as well. But look over for just a moment, Proverbs 11 and verse 3. He says here, the wisdom writer says, the integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of the treacherous shall destroy them. Now notice this. If you are walking in integrity, you're walking in uprightness, and you're consistently doing so, that's going to be a protection. That's going to be a shield to you. There will be times when you face difficulty. There might be times when people say things that are not true. But what evidence are they going to have for that?
Now, in contrast, in Proverbs 11, verse 3, he talks about the perverseness of the wicked is going to be their destruction. Those who tell lies will then have to tell another lie to cover that one up, and they'll have to do another little deception over here to cover that one up, and on the web of lies goes, and it gets thinner and more frail as they go. More and more holes as you go. There, you can't string together enough lies to cover it up. Some people may be very good at lying, but the point is, lies are not a very good protection. Because once they are seen for what they are, it ruins your character. People don't trust you. People aren't going to use you and rely upon you for whatever it is that's connected with. All sorts of things start crumbling down. We also may consider different situations in our lives as Christians. And, you know, we don't go around looking for people to do these kinds of things, but sometimes we find this happening among brethren. I've heard brethren who will answer the phone and it's a call for somebody in the house. That person says, well, tell them I'm not here. And we're not thinking about, well, I'm trying to tell them, well, I'm not thinking that way. We're just, well, I don't want to talk to them, or I'm busy, or whatever. But is that the truth when we say, tell them I'm not here? Well, that is not truth. That's not honesty. And remember, 1 John said, no lie is of the truth. And so if we react this way, it is deception. Now, a better response would be to say, well, tell them that I am occupied at the moment, or I'm not going to talk to them now, I'll talk to them later, whatever. We can give an honest answer without saying things that are untrue, even unintentionally. Trying to avoid talking to somebody or whatever that we might be miffed at. That's something that can happen. And we need to avoid that. Also, we could talk about empty promises. Maybe it's the father who wants to spend time with his kids, or his kids wants to spend time with daddy. And they ask daddy, well, can we go do this? Can we go fishing? Or can we go do that? And dad says, sure, we'll do that. But dad never makes time. And now, is that an intentional lie? Not necessarily. But is it honesty if we are not really going to do that? And we don't keep our word? Empty promises. Promising and saying we're going to do something when we're not going to do it. That is not the way we need to be. Matthew 23, we're not going to read that right now, but Matthew 23, 16 through 22, Jesus rebuked the Pharisees and the Jews of that day because they would swear by this part of the temple or that part of the temple, and they say, well, if you swear by these aspects, well, you can kind of get out of it, it won't be so bad. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, see, that's valuable. Don't worry about the altar, worry about the gold that's covering those things. Then you have to keep your word. And so their honesty and their faithfulness to their word was based upon what they swore on. And so they were playing this little shell game with their word. What's the point of them ever making any promise if they weren't intending to keep it? Or if they were going to try to find a way out of it? What's the point? You see, that's deception. And that is not honesty. And we need to avoid those kinds of things, whether they're intentional or whether they're unintentional. We need to avoid that. We could also look at Ephesians chapter 5 and notice that there are some very clear comments about vulgar speech. In Ephesians 5 verse 3, he says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as becometh saints, nor filthiness, nor foolish talking or jesting, which are not befitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know of a surety, that no fornicator, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. So here, as he talks about fornication and uncleanness being often associated with that homosexuality and immorality of those kinds of behaviors, and right hand in hand with that is speech that is unclean, filthy, or as we might say, coarse. Now, he's not saying here you can't ever jest in the sense of making a joke, being funny or humorous in a clean way. But clearly the context is talking about fornication, uncleanness, filthy things. Jesting in that context is to be avoided by us as Christians. Just to define three of the words that are in this context. The word filthy in the American Standard Version, it's the first word you read in chapter 5, verse 4. Nor filthiness. in the American Standard Version. That word means shameful things, or libel, or obscene comments. Joking about things and just putting it out there on the table, being crude. That kind of conversation, that kind of comments are things that we do not need to be involved in as Christians. There's a second word there in verse 4. It talks about foolishness. Well, what is that? Well, literally, the Greek word is what we get our word moron or stupidity from. That's translated. The idea is things that are morally lacking. The idea is from the word, a concept. It's lacking wisdom, lacking the understanding of what is really valuable and good and beneficial. It's that moral or spiritual deficiency in understanding that you know, what is this that we're talking about? How does this help us spiritually be the kind of people we need to be? And it's not trying to be insulting and calling people moronic, but we understand that term is a very strong term in our language. To call somebody a moron is very rude. But that's the root word to this idea of foolishness, and that's the word that means fool. It's lacking wisdom. Doing something that just is contrary to everything that we should be as Christians. And the word jesting here, again, is not condemning humor in a general sense, but it's in this context of things immoral, unclean, morally lacking in understanding of what is right before God. The word jesting is literally to well turn. What's that idea? Well turned. Well, there are jokes that have a sense of humor to them in the context of vulgarity, indecency, sexual innuendos and double meanings, turn phrases that people chuckle at. You know, I've even heard two preachers joke before, and I really wonder what was going on with them. Two preachers joke, and they didn't use a single bad word. They didn't say anything that would be on the surface nasty. But the second or subtle meaning of it certainly was not clean. You know what? That's exactly what this is condemning. Where people don't use words that are outright evil in themselves, but they use them in a context in a way that's kind of like, well, I didn't say it. You may have thought it, but I didn't say it. That's exactly what we're talking about here. Jesting. Turning that phrase in a vulgar way. And that is what we need to avoid as well. These things, along with fornication and uncleanness, are not going to help us get to heaven. And so we need to beware those kinds of things. Again, in the category of corrupt or decaying speech, we can look at explicatives. Or we say, well, what's an explicative? It means an outburst, something you just say. An explicative is that kind of a thing. Or a curse word is what we commonly call them today. Well, in Matthew 26, let's turn over there now. This is where we get our title from in our lesson this evening, Thy Speech Maketh Thee Known. If you remember Matthew 26, Jesus is going through this mockery of a trial and being harassed and accused of all sorts of things. And here's Peter standing without in this crowd, warming himself at the fire. And one comes up to him and says, you're a Galilean. You're one of the followers of Christ. And Peter denies it. Someone comes again and says, I know you're one of the followers of Christ. And he says, no, you don't know what you're talking about. But then in chapter 26 and verse 73, it is asserted again. And he says, in a little while they stood by and came and said to Peter, of a truth, thou also art one of them, for thy speech maketh thee known. We know you're a Galilean. You have that form of speech or that dialect. You sound like those who've been running with Jesus. We picked up on that. And his response, then began he to curse and to swear, I know not the man. And the cock crew, and he went out and wept bitterly. But can you imagine? Here is one who would eventually become an apostle of Jesus Christ. Here he was in training at this point. And just a few hours before, he said, I'd never betray him. And then that tongue, that unruly, untamable tongue, suddenly, because of fear of what might happen to him if he confessed being a follower of Christ, he cursed, I don't even know the blankety-blank man. And this was Peter. If it can happen to him, could it happen to any of us? We see other passages, Ephesians 4:29. This is where I've been taking this second point from, a corrupt speech. Talks about corrupt. That word means rotten or worthless speech. That's not to proceed out of our mouth. That's not to be involved in our conversation and our words and the things that we utter. We also see Ephesians 4:29 as well as Ephesians 5:4. There was a second point there in 4:29. Let me turn back over there and highlight that. But there it's talking about empty or useless words in the sense, and I wanted to apply that to taking God's name in vain or using it in a careless way. Ephesians 4:29 says, "Let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but such as is good for edifying, as the need may be, that it may give grace to them that hear." So here you have a contrast. Corrupt or decaying speech that can proceed out of our mouth. In contrast, we need speech that's good, produces edifying, and that may give grace or benefit. Now, what kind of speech is it if we take God's name carelessly? We stub our toe and we say, "Oh God." Well, are we speaking in reverence? Are we speaking in respect? Are we crying out for help? Or are we just saying it flippantly? How are we saying it? Am I saying we should never say God's name or call out to Him? No. Am I saying if you're in a car wreck and you scream out, "God help me," is that wrong? No, I'm not saying that. Because we should be in moments like that calling out to God. But if we use it carelessly, without respect, without reverence, then that is indeed corrupt speech, not edifying or good speech. Then chapter 5 and verse 4 again, when he talks about filthiness or foolish or unwise speech, foolish talking or jesting, which are not befitting, but rather giving of thanks. Notice that last phrase, giving of thanks. How do we speak of God? Is it in the context of, like I said, respect, reverence, gratitude to Him? Or is it just flippant and careless speech in reference to Him? A lot of times we hear in TV, or maybe the radio, maybe in our work relationships, people speak carelessly about God. But He is one that always deserves respect. What do we say when we are surprised? What do we say when we're angry? What do we say when we're frustrated? Those are some signs of what's going on in our heart, whether we're building up our faith and being strong in our faith and having the understanding that needs to be there, or whether we may be a little lacking and needing to work on those areas in our life. Again, in connection with corrupt speech, there's a word that is called euphemisms. You've probably heard this before, but simply, euphemisms are words that are softer than curse words, that are substitutes for explicatives or cuss words. Just like you have hard drinks, which are like alcohols and things like that, that will intoxicate you, and then they call soft drinks because they're not intoxicating and they're in that category. Well, in this category, it's not acceptable to do this. This is not soft or, "Well, that's okay." This is a cover-up, if you will, a substitute for something that is not right and not respectful. These words are substitute for curse words. Now, I've got a Webster's Dictionary. I think it's sitting in my office on the desk. And you can look up a lot of these words and a number of others that I don't have on this list, and you will see it stands for blank. And they're curse words. Now, not all dictionaries do that. But there are dictionaries that will tell you those things plainly, and it's quite an eye-opener. And so if you're wondering, if I don't hit on something up here and you say, "Well, is this one of those?" Well, look at a couple of dictionaries and eventually you'll find it and you'll see. And you won't have to worry or have any doubt about that kind of thing. Here's just a few of the common ones. The word darn or dang or drat stands for the D word. And the word damn or to condemn is a biblical word. It is used in a context in which we can speak and use it as the Bible uses it. But people have taken that word, a useful word in the Bible context, and used it as a curse word, and it becomes something that God never intended it to be. Just like people take God's name and use it in a way that is often a curse word. We can talk about God plus, condemning somebody. That's a very strong curse word. And you're using God's name in that way. And yet, it's used that way. Well, we have a substitute for God as well, gosh or golly. Doesn't that sound innocent? I can remember hearing those old shows, the black and white shows, and you have Gomer Pyle or all these other guys saying, "Oh, gosh, and stuff like that. And,
you know, we chuckle.
But that's not using a reference that is respectful toward God. Gee whiz, or geez, that's a summary or a substitute, if you will, for Jesus. You got heck standing for hell again. Hell's a Bible word. You can speak of hell, but people use it as a curse word. Just like over in Britain, the word bloody is a curse word. Now, we talk about something that, you know, you bloody his nose or something, we're not cursing.
But people have taken a normal word and used it in a derogatory way, a very corrupt way.
That's what we're talking about, corrupt speech. We might think of Batman and think of holy smoke, holy cow, you know how Robin always did that. Well, you know what? He's taking a reference to holy and using it flippantly, isn't he? And that's something that is not very respectful. Whether that's specifically a reference to the Holy Spirit or not, covering up for that, it's still using this concept of holiness and just tossing it around. You know, holiness is not a joke. Being holy and things that are holy are not to be joked about that way. And we already mentioned this one right there about gosh darn. Those things are standing for words that are not used in appropriate ways. And we could just ask the question, can't we find better things to say? Surely we can. You know, if we need help, we go to a dictionary, find something else. Find something funny to say. Find something else. Or just be quiet. Bite your tongue if you have to. You know, I know some people that instead of having the words that they used to say, they say, old potato. You know, something that has no bad meaning whatsoever, and it's kind of funny when you say it, and you stub your toe, old potato. Well, you know, that's better than saying things that we shouldn't say. You know, find something. If we have to say something, find something better. But can you imagine? Can you just imagine Christ saying these kinds of things? Oh, we know He would never just curse outright, but would He say, oh, holy smoke? Would He do that? That just doesn't seem to fit with the picture that we see of Jesus in the New Testament. He certainly seemed to have a lot more respect and reverence for God and for the things that determine right and wrong. We look at also at corrupt speech. Many, many passages, Old Testament, New, we're not going to spend a lot of time on these last couple of points, but many passages talk about murmuring, which is complaining, grumbling, expressions of dissatisfaction, sometimes expression of jealousy, like in the Old Testament, where people were jealous of the authority of Moses and the rebellion of Korah. You know, they said, well, Moses, you take too much on yourselves. All the people are holy. We can stand up here and do the same thing as these priests are. And so who are you, Moses, to make all these distinctions and put us down here and them up there? And so they were envious and jealous of how things were with other people. And so they were in connection with rebellion. But Matthew chapter 20 and verse 11 is a good illustration of this. Here we have the man who went out and hired laborers in his vineyard. Went out early in the morning and told them, I'll give you a day's wage. Went out a little bit later in the day and said, well, I'll hire you and I'll give you what you're worth. Went out all through the day. And the last of the day, when there was only an hour left, he found some more there. And they said, why haven't you been working? He says, no man's hired us. He says, okay, well, go to my vineyard and work. And I'll pay you what's just or what's due. The end of the day, he started with that last group that only worked 1 hour, and he gave them a full day's wage. And he went down the line paying all those guys who worked part of the day, more and more of the day, paid them a day's wage. And when you got to the last one who worked all day, they were thinking, well, he paid them all the day's wage, and they didn't work the whole day. Ooh, what's he going to pay us? And he paid them a day's wage, and they looked at that, and they looked at those other people over there, and they started grumbling. They started murmuring. And Jesus responds in the parable. Look at Matthew 20 and verse 11. When they received it, they murmured against the householder, saying, these last have spent but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us who have borne the burden of the day in the scorching heat. But he answered and said to one of them, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a shilling? Take up that which is thine and go thy way. It is my will to give unto the last, even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Or is thine eye evil because I am good? So the last shall be first and the first shall be last. He says, what have I done that I've wronged you? I haven't wronged you. You agreed for a day's wage. You got a day's wage. Just because I've been good and kind to these other people, does that mean that you need to be jealous of me and what I've done with them? And murmur? The idea there clearly is there's a complaint, a grumbling, a dissatisfaction, jealousy of what others had. And so they were complaining in that sense. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 10 warns that we as Christians can fall into that same thing that old Israel did in murmuring against God, in which case many died under the Old Testament. There were times when God struck them down for murmuring. It's not a light matter. But it's very easy for us as we go through life to be dissatisfied. That all happens to all of us. And then we start to grumble. Oh, we don't like this. We don't like that. And there's a sense in which we have to address things and correct things. We're not talking about that. But when we just kind of grumble over that and speak about it and express our dissatisfaction and we got to tell people about that and resist things that are not wrong, as in Matthew 20, verse 11 illustrates, nothing had been done wrong to them, and yet they complained because they wanted to be treated better than what they were treated. So that's what we're talking about there. Being dissatisfied with things that are right, things that are good, where they haven't been mistreated, and yet there's this expression of complaint and grumble. We can also see in Philippians 2, verse 14, where it talks about murmuring and disputing. As I know the American Standard Version puts it, and I forget the word, but King James phrases it a little differently. But murmuring and disputing. And that word is being like argumentative, just contesting things, or not like being rebellious, expressing your dissatisfaction over things. It's easy to get into that. But those are things that we are to put away from our life and to realize that if something is not sinful, what do we have to complain about? Yes, there's times in life when things are not fair. But look at how Jesus dealt with things like that. He tried to correct them or tried to deal with them properly. But even when he was being put to death, was that fair? Was that just? And yet the Bible says he opened not his mouth. He didn't revile again those who reviled him. You know, that's very hard to do. You know, it's easy to lash out with that tongue. I may not be able to control the situation and make things right, but I'm sure get them with my tongue. That's easy to do. And we've got to rein that back in. It's very difficult at times. But it is the thing that we need to do and avoid those things that are condemned here. We can also look at 3 John in verse 10, where there's a comment there about malicious words, words that are mean-spirited or hurtful intentionally so. There are times when we say things that we shouldn't, and it's not intentional, and we've got to watch out for that. But in this context, he says, speaking of Diotrephes, therefore if we come, I will bring to remembrance his works which he doeth, prating against us with wicked words, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and them that he would, he forbiddeth them and casteth them out to the church. American Standard Version says wicked words. King James Version says malicious words. And that's that idea of intentionally hurtful, mean-spirited words. He knows they're going to hurt, and that's why he's saying them. Because he's trying to manipulate the situation or whatnot. And that's the idea of malicious words there. Now, in contrast to all these kinds of things, and perhaps there's other things we could hit on that I've not touched on this evening. In contrast to that, we've already read over in Ephesians 4 this point that we're going to look at now. Good words. Words that are beneficial. Words that are acceptable before God. And in Ephesians 4, verse 29, he says, let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but here's what should come out of your mouth, such as is good for edifying, as the need may be, that it may give grace to them that hear. Good. What does that mean? Beneficial. It's helpful. It actually is doing something that is constructive, if you will. It is something that is not corrupt, tearing down moral or spiritual understanding and degrading people in their relationship with God and being immoral and things of that nature, promoting things that are bad. Rather, it's promoting things that God is pleased with. It's beneficial. Speech in that category. It also says good for the use of edifying. Again, the concept there of building spiritually. Now, there are a range of things that are involved in edifying. It doesn't exclude the fact that you have to condemn sin and tear down those things to stand in the way of building properly. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 10, Paul, in saying
to the Corinthians that he doesn't want to have to come to them with the authority he has for edification, but he does admit there in the passage that I have power, I have authority to tear some things down and to condemn things. I don't want to come that way, but if you make me, I will. And so it admits that there's an authority. There's the place for that, though we don't prefer that. We understand that building a house, you have to clean off the area, make it level and make it straight and right so that you can build properly that house or that construction. We understand the range of things going on there. We also see that it must minister or serve grace. What does that mean, serve grace? Well, you've already seen my answer to that, instructive. The idea of grace, a lot of times we might bring across the idea of something pleasant, but really, as the Bible uses the term, look at Titus chapter 2 and verse 11. Titus 2 verse 11 says, "For the grace of God hath appeared, bringing what? Bringing salvation to all men, instructing us." Well, here's this wonderful blessing of grace, and yet, how is it accomplished? How is it ministered? How is it brought to us? Through instruction, through the teaching of the gospel, through the Word of God. And so here, our words need to be of this nature and of this category. Beneficial, building the things God wants built, and producing that instruction, that guidance, that benefit that's in harmony with His will. Now, our words of that quality and of that character. Not just when we come together, not just when we sing songs that have been written and designed for spiritual edification, but our words this way when we go to work. When we're in our home with our family, when we're driving down the road and we're talking with our family, whatever we're doing, are our words of this quality and this character? Colossians 4 adds this comment to think about when we deal with our tongue and our speech, that they need to be seasoned with salt. Let me just read the passage there and get all of it. Colossians 4 verse 6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." Now, that's going to take some work and some forethought, isn't it? We don't need to be careless with our tongues, with our speech, but rather plan ahead of time. Know how to answer people. And let it be seasoned with salt. What does salt do, by the way? Well, we know that it stops corruption, and it adds flavor, adds taste. And when you think about the nature of truth, God's Word, it does those two things. When truth is promoted and truth is upheld, it is discouraging that which is wrong. You think about it. Do people who curse want to hear about the Word of God when they're just going around cursing and saying their words? And you just say, "Well, God bless you." Sometimes you don't know what else to say to people. Just let words come out of their mouth. You say, "God bless you." And they kind of look at you funny. Well, if they can curse, I can bless them, right? And that makes them conscious of, you know, they're saying things they shouldn't say. And sometimes they get mad. But so what? It stops corruption. That might be looked at as negative, but that's what it does. Salt does that. In fact, they used to take meats and they would just cover them in salt to preserve that meat and make it last longer. It stops corruption. Also, it adds flavor. You know, we use salt even to this day. We have refrigerators to preserve our foods better. But we use salt even to this day to add flavor, to add that taste, just to bring out the flavor and the savor of the meat or whatever it is you're accenting with that salt. And that's the idea of that. Things that are good, things that are right, things that are pleasing to God. You know, those things, the world may not find those attractive, but those of us who realize what is holiness, what is righteousness, what is godliness, we realize, you know, that's tasty. That's pleasant things. Those are things that you can do and not feel guilty for, not be condemned for. You don't have to be embarrassed and hide that. You can be this way, and it's perfectly right and good. That's flavorful, spiritually speaking. So here is what salt does, and this is how our speech is to be. Matthew 12, as we conclude, Matthew 12, verse 36 and 37 tells us that we will be judged by every idle word. Now that's a pretty strict statement. Every casual, idle word that we say is going to be considered in our judgment. You know, that makes me think, you know, I better watch my tongue. Whether I'm around other people or by myself or how I speak to my wife or my neighbors, You know, that's something we got to work on. And, you know, it's not easy sometimes. As we noted in James 3, the tongue is the most difficult part of our body to control. If you can control that, you can control anything about your body. And so it's something that we need to focus on greatly and pay attention to and realize that we will be judged by these things. But gratefully, though we know in all things, we know in many ways, as James 3 also says, in many ways we all stumble. We understand that as we're trying to do what's right, we have it in our heart, I want to go to heaven, I want to serve God, I want to please Him, I want to be a better person. At the same time, there are times when all of us fall short and stumble. And when we find ourselves in that situation, whether it's dealing with our tongue and our speech or some other aspect of our life, we can be grateful that God has provided a means of forgiveness. Not based upon, well, you've lived perfectly so you get into heaven. No, we know that's not it. Rather, it's because of Christ and what He has done in dying upon the cross, shedding His blood, which we remember every Lord's Day. Based upon that, we can say, Lord, please forgive me and give me another chance. And He will forgive us. And we do that, first of all, by becoming Christians. And once you are a Christian, then you can do that by prayer and repentance, Acts 8:22. This evening, if anyone here needs to respond to the gospel, please do so. Please be a recipient, one who accepts the blessings of God that are so abundantly showered upon us through Christ. Do that this evening while we stand and while we sing.